Iambic Audiobooks presents The Other by Matthew Hughes, read by Edward Willett. Chapter 1. The subtle simplicity of the trap took Luff Imbrie by surprise. Ordinarily, he would never have agreed to a meeting in a setting as insecure as the Balmain seawall. In recent years, Imbrie had grown far too corpulent for energetic foot races, which would be his only recourse for escape if agents of the Bureau of Scrutiny interrupted the proposed transaction with Barlow Crimm. His heroic girth was the main reason he now conducted almost all of his business at Bolly's Snug, an ancient tavern with a warren of rentable private rooms that offered absolute privacy and, for those who paid the extra tariff, unconventional exits in times of emergency. But Barlow Crimm was as trustworthy and careful a contact as Imbrie could have wanted, a scion of an extensive family whose members operated throughout the half-world, as the criminal underpinnings of the impossibly ancient city of Orkney were wont to call themselves. Since time immemorial, the Crimms had acquired and sold goods, always of fine quality and high value, though their provenances would not bear too close inspection. Imbrie had done business with a dozen of them, finding them always to be consummate professionals, if hard bargainers. But then, Imbrie found that a good haggle stimulated both mind and body, if the dickerers were practiced in the art. Barlow was now midway through his career, a settled family man who rarely went out himself, and then only if the prospects were exceptional and if the house's defenses were such as to yield only to an expert's nudges and tickles. He had long since moved up in the family hierarchy to become a middler, receiving from younger Crimms and their associates, and selling on to fronters such as Imbrie, who would deal directly, or almost so, with the eventual purchasers. So when Barlow Crimm contracted Imbrie through a secure channel, offering to sell a set of custom-made knuckle-knackers, the fat man was immediately interested and said, "I will reserve a room at Bolly's for tomorrow after lunch, if that will suit." "No," said the middler. "Ildefons is away to visit her sister all this week, and I'm taking care of little Mull. Ildi would have mine teeth for tiddlywinks if I took the child into Bolly's, or anywhere like it." Imbrie had asked where he proposed to make the exchange, and Crimm had suggested the seawall, near the playground where his daughter loved to play on the bubble pops and flip-sliders. The fat man had suggested that they defer their business until Ildefons returned, but Crimm had foreclosed that option. "I have them for only 3 days," he said, "and if I cannot move them in that time, the consigner will come back and seek another intermediary." "He is in a great hurry," Imbrie said. "An off-worlder," was the explanation. "A freighter man here in a brief stopover. When his ship departs, he must go with it, and if he has not sold the items on old Earth, he will try on some other world." Hurry-ups always aroused Imbrie's suspicions. "He came well vouched for?" "By the Osgroffs on talk," Crimm said. "Code and grip?" But the middler assured him that the seller had spoken the right syllables and interlocked his fingers with Crimm's in the appropriate manner. "And the knuckle-knackers, they are first-rate?" "Prime. Custom-made for a discerning client who intends to visit a rough and risky little planet out near the back of beyond. He wanted a backup in case he was ever relieved of his external weaponry." "They cannot have done him much good, though," said Imbrie, "if some crewman off a common carrier is hawking them." He was told that the knuckle-knacker's owner had bought passage on the tramp freighter, after hailing it to stop at some rude little world where he was stranded and where no passenger liner would ever call. Unused to the rudimentary standards of such vessels, he had stepped into an open hatch above a cargo hold while under the mistaken impression that a descender would automatically bear him lightly down. Instead, he had plunged to a neck-snapping impact on the unyielding deck plates. Since he carried no identification, custom permitted that he be buried in space and his effects gambled for among the crew. The 6 small hemispheres had ended up in the possession of the under-supercargo, who went looking for a buyer at the freighter's next port of call, the foundational domain, Talk. "And the Osgroves didn't want them?" Imbrie said. "A virulent new social dynamic is at play on Talk," Crimm said. "Radical pacifism. Anyone who has truck with weapons will not be received in even the meanest establishment." "Curious," said the fat man. "I wonder how the Osgroves maintain discipline." "Harsh words and cold looks, I'm told." "Remarkable," said Imbrie. He thought for a moment, then said, "As it happens, I heard recently that a sometime client of mine is in the market for knuckle-knackers, if they are of a fine cut." "They are that," said Crimm. And so a price was agreed upon, contingent on the goods being as advertised, and Imbri agreed to meet the middler and his freckle-faced daughter that afternoon along the strand of dressed black stone that separated the gray waters of Mornity Sound from the tip of the long peninsula on which Orkney sprawled. But it was not for nothing that he had remained free from the close attention of the Bureau of Scrutiny, nor from several members of the half-world who believed that Luff Imbri was owed a comeuppance. Before he left for the rendezvous, he equipped himself with both a shocker and a needle-thrower, and sent aloft a whirlaway fitted with surveillance percepts. 5 minutes' walk from the meeting-point, Imbri contacted the whirlaway and was informed that a man answering the middler's description was standing at the edge of the seawall, accompanied by a short person who fit Mull Crim's specifications. The latter was taking small objects from a bag and throwing them toward several water-birds who were contending with each other to snap them up. No other persons, or non-persons, were in the vicinity. Imbri advanced along the gently curving promenade until he spotted the two. The whirlaway reported no change in the situation. The fat man stepped up to them, one hand in his pocket clutching the needle-thrower, while the other offered Crim a particular arrangement of fingers. A specific counter-signal from Crim would indicate that all was as it should be. Crim raised his hand, his fingers taking the right positions, but Imbri's gaze went to the middler's face, which was stark and pale. He was already raising the needle-thrower, even as he heard the middler say, "What could I do, Luff? They've got Mull and Ildi!" But even as the last words were spoken, the girl's hand was already out of the bread-bag, except that it wasn't a girl's hand, but a hairy, stub-fingered fist that, instead of crumbs, was wrapped around a crackler, the emitter of which was trained on Imbri. He saw a pulse of blue light and felt a rush of cold fire spread from a spot in his chest out first to his limbs, with which he immediately lost touch, and then to his head, which rang like a silent bell. The face framed by the girl's bonnet was coarse-featured and stubble-darkened. The eyes were pale and hard as half-polished agate, and the angry sneer that disfigured the lips now widened as the half-man stepped clear of Barlow Crim and gave the hapless decoy a long dose of the crackler's energies. By now Imbri was lying on his side, immobile on the stone flagging of the promenade, from where he saw the middler topple head-first toward the sea to the squawks of outraged avians who preferred bread. The small man came and kicked the needle-thrower clear of Imbri's inert hand, then used the same short limb and boot-clad foot to drive the air from his lungs. The impact caused the fat man to sprawl onto his back, and now he could see, descending rapidly toward him, a carry-all of the kind used to ferry passengers to orbiting spaceships that did not wish to incur port charges by landing. The little man looked up at the vehicle, and when he looked back down at Imbri, he was wearing an expression Imbri found odd, as if Imbri had put his assailant to a great deal of trouble and was resented for it. Then the half-man aimed the crackler again, the blue pulsed once more, and Luff Imbri fell into the deep cold. He awoke on a utilitarian bunk in a small metal room. The wall beside him vibrated almost imperceptibly. His throat was dry and his head was full of dull thunder. He moved his tongue to encourage saliva and then swallowed. "Ship's integrator," he said. "Yes," came a neutral voice that spoke as if from the air. "I am thirsty." Only a moment passed before a panel levered itself down from the opposite wall to form a rudimentary table. A portion of the floor rose to form a seat. A hatch opened at the rear of the table and produced a sealed pitcher and a tumbler. Imbri rose stiffly from the bunk and made his way to the table. There was just enough room to fit the dome of his stomach between the stool and the table. He unsealed the pitcher and sniffed its contents. A good red ale that he often ordered when lunching at Labonian's Tavern, one of his favorite haunts. He poured a few drops into the tumbler and sampled it. If the brew had been adulterated, not even his finely honed palate could detect it. He discounted the possibility. If his captor wanted to poison him or alter the responses of his cerebrum, there were a dozen gases that could be emitted into the cabin. He filled the tumbler and drank it down, following the draft with a capacious belch. The ale quieted the rawness in the back of his throat and seemed even to moderate the ache in his head. "I am also hungry," he told the ship's integrator. "What would you like?" it said. For Imbri, that was never an idle question. He had not acquired his extraordinary shape. He was easily the most corpulent man in all of Orkney, by dint of mere volume of intake. He was a gourmet, not a gourmand, and his gustatory apparatus was exquisitely tuned. Without much hope, he said, "Can you make a gripple egg omelet?" "No." Imbri was disappointed, though not surprised. "How about a 5-layered ragu?" "Do you mind if it is reconstituted?" "Then you are not a luxury yacht." "You must henceforward draw your own conclusions," the ship said. "You have tricked me into giving you information. I will prepare the ragu." Imbri refilled the tumbler and sipped the ale while he thought about what he had learned. The exchange with the integrator provided the fat man with information that was simultaneously reassuring and worrisome. Whoever had snatched him up did not intend to demean and insult him by making him beg for stale crusts. But anyone who knew him well and cared for his comforts would have laid in a supply of high-end comestibles. The fact that the ship's larder contained no gripple eggs meant that he could abandon the faint hope that he was being hired by someone off-world who knew that the thief would not have responded warmly to a conventional approach. Such a person would almost certainly have been wealthy enough to own a yacht it could dispatch for the operation. With that hope dashed, Imbri had to assume that his kidnapper harbored darker plans. His captivity was likely connected to someone's long-held grudge, not to be settled quickly or easily. A chime sounded, and the food appeared in the hatch, along with eating implements. Imbri sampled the stew, found it more than adequate. He called for another mug of ale and a pot of hot punch to follow the meal, and set to work with fork and spoon. After the hatch had reabsorbed the utensils and dishes, and the punch was steaming in Imbri's cup, the integrator asked if he required diversion. "I suppose there's no possibility of taking a walk about the ship," the fat man said. "None." "Or of conversing with its owner?" "Nor that." "Will you tell me who he is?" "No." "Is he aboard?" "No." "Is anyone apart from me?" "Tukol is in his cabin." "He would be the short individual who crackled me?" "Yes." "Is he a close confidant of the owner or a temporary hire?" "I will not answer," said the integrator. "I am instructed to withhold information that might identify my employer." "You are aware that I am aboard you against my will?" "I am." "And that does not offend your ethical constituents?" "They appear to have been modified." "But not completely disabled?" "No." That was as Imbri had expected. A ship's integrator absolved of all ethical constraints might deem it a suitable punishment to murder a passenger just for spilling gravy on its spotless decking. This one would observe civilized standards, but would otherwise offer Imbri all assistance short of the actual help he needed. "Can you tell me to what world we are traveling?" he said.
"No, nor anything that might help you deduce our destination."
"So I am to be carried blindly to some unknown world at the behest of an unknown person, but I am to be delivered there sound of body," the fat man said, and then added pointedly, "and of mind?"
"You will be issued medication when we approach a whimsy," said the ship.
Imbri was glad to hear it. It was unwise to enter one of those oddities that made interstellar travel possible without first dulling the mind well below the threshold of dreams. The human brain was not equipped to confront the irreality that assaulted the senses and outraged reason until the return to normal space.
"Again," said the integrator, "do you require diversion?"
"Have you men done study of 19th Aeon porcelain?" A screen appeared in the air before him and instantly filled with the frontispiece of Mendern's massive treatise. "Chapter 12, said Imbri. The display changed to show a block of text with accompanying images. Imbri settled himself on the bunk and re-immersed himself in the long-dead academic's theory of how the ceramicists of old had achieved their lustrous glazes, shot through with the most unlikely colors. It was a mystery he had long desired to penetrate. He was still engaged when the first gentle bong sounded to warn him that they were approaching a whimsy. When he had shaken off the muzziness of the medications, the ship produced a breakfast of sweetbreads, fruit, small spiced sausages, and punch. After cleaning his plate and calling for another mug of punch, Imbri asked for the Mendern again and resumed his studies. 19th Aeon ceramics had been for some years now one of his interests, not just because the surviving works from that now-dim era were items of rare and startling beauty, but because the person who was able to duplicate the long-lost process, which had been a hermetically held secret of the Ceramicists' Guild even in the 19th Aeon, would hold the key to a fortune. That was the kind of key that Luff Imbri longed to slip into the lock of his life. The trade in 19th Aeon pots and vases was small but select. They rarely came onto the market, and when they did, buyers outnumbered sellers by huge ratios. Imbrie's plump hands had only once held a piece from the period, a wide-necked vessel attributed to one of the pupils of Amberlane, with an exquisite design of gold-chased geometric figures set against a russet-toned background. And he had not held it for any longer than necessary, since it was changing hands from one owner to the next in an informal manner, Imbrie having stolen it on order for a collector in Orkney. The transaction had netted Imbrie a healthy fee, but the proceeds would have been far greater if the fat man had been selling the piece on the open market rather than slipping the goods, as the practice of selling on dubiously acquired items was known in the Orkney half-world. But the only way that he was ever likely to become a seller of 19th aeon ceramics was if he first became a forger of them. And the key to their forging, and thus to a fortune, was to rediscover the lost arcana of materials and technique by which they were originally produced. It was not that Imbrie minded being a thief. It was his living, and he was acknowledged to be one of the best. But he enjoyed forging far more, especially when the product of his hand was every bit the equal in materials and execution as the original that it mimicked. Through a close study of Mindern and other sources, he believed that he had deduced the process by which the most striking glazes had been achieved. He had experimented several times over the years, using clays from the same white mud deposits that the Amberlane and Tanclo had favored, and varying his temperatures and firing times. The results had been close enough to tantalize, though nowhere near the quality that would have fooled an aficionado. Imbrie was convinced that the secret lay in the materials. The masters of old had mixed a peculiar blend of unique substances to make their viridant greens, their violet-tinged blues, their grand purples and stygian blacks. But the materials had been transmuted by the process, so that even grinding shards of a broken 19th aeon urn into dust, then subjecting the motes to incandescent spectrum analysis, yielded only hints of what had originally been pestled into powder in the guild's mortars. Baron Mindern had gone further than any in his attempts to reverse artisan the secret ingredient. He had been able to identify some of its molecular structure. A schematic appeared in his treatise, but the original substance had been destroyed during the kilning and could not be reconstructed. As he had put it in his great work, 19th Aeon Ceramics, a summing up, "Something there was that these master ceramicists brought to their labors that none wot of but they. After a lifetime's battle to wrest their secret from the dead, I must accept that they clasp it still." Yet anything that had been known once could be known again, Imbrie believed. His was an incisive mind, married to a broad understanding of how the universe was put together. He would continue to pursue the question whenever he was not more directly occupied in conducting what he usually referred to as an operation, and if the problem had a solution, there was no one more likely than he to uncover it. Lunch was a ginger-pot soup, followed by a succession of rich, meat-filled pastries, and concluded with a delicate tort. The accompanying wines were more than satisfactory, and the selection of essences that constituted the encore was the equal of what Imbrie would have expected at some of the finer eateries in Orkney. As the last vapors effervesced through his senses, he said, "Integrator, that was a worthy meal." "Thank you," said the voice. "Was the menu your creation or your master's?" "I cannot say." "Well, either way, I compliment you or him, or both, since not only was the choice of the elements of the meal finely made, but the preparation and presentation did you credit. With the right menu, you might consider entering the Grand Gastronomicon on Tintamare."
"Again, thank you. Would you like the Mindern again?"
"Not now. I would prefer a conversation."
"I am not at liberty to tell you
whose ship I am on," Imbrie interrupted, "nor where we are bound, nor what will happen to me when we get there."
"Indeed."
"Then tell me what you can tell me."
Integrators never had to pause to think, but sometimes did so in order to enhance the impression that they conversed with human beings on an equal level. "You are being taken to another world, to which you must be delivered hale and whole, your faculties intact. There you will be under the care of Tukol."
"So I will not be suddenly ejected into space between whimsies?"
Among some of Old Earth's criminal organizations, this was a favorite way of disposing of persons who had become inconvenient or surplus to requirements. "No."
"Will I require any special clothing or equipment?"
"Suitable clothing will be provided. No special equipment will be needed." Will I be alone, except for Tukol? It is a populated world.
Will the mystery be revealed upon planet fall, or will there be further chapters?
That I cannot say. Nimbri thought for a moment, then added, Are you comfortable with your role in these proceedings? The question does not apply.
The ship was offering Imbri no encouragement to try to winkle more information from it. The information confirmed what Imbri had surmised. It seemed that he was in the grip of someone to whom he had done an injury, someone who intended a settling of accounts. It behooved the fat man to think on who that someone might be. It would be a long think, there being a long list of someones who might fit the description.
Time passed. Another whimsy came and went, then a long passage through normal space.
Imbri did not bother to try to glean from this scant information any clue as to where he was being carried. Some whimsies would move a ship halfway down the spray, others no more than a few stars over. And the length of time it took to pass through the stretches of normal space between whimsies varied according to the speed of the ship. Having traversed two whimsies since leaving Old Earth, Imbri could be effectively anywhere. Lacking the cooperation of a ship's integrator, he would know nothing of his whereabouts until he stepped out at his destination and looked at the sky. Even then, he might know little. It was a 3-day passage after the second whimsy, judging by the clock in Imbri's stomach and the regular appearance of meals to reset it. After lunch on the third day, a cheese soufflé with toasted flavored bread served with a thin and sharp-edged wine, followed by a multi-layered fruit flan and a pot of punch, he called for the Mindern again.
"You will not have time," said the ship.
Imbri attuned himself to the vibration in the walls, noticed that it was now a deeper thrum, just below the limits of audibility. "We are landing," he said.
"Yes. Prepare to disembark."
The dishes were cleared away, and a small hatch opened in another wall.
"Please place your clothing in the receptacle," said the integrator.
Imbri did so, stripping down to his remarkable physique. His clothes disappeared.
"Now what?" he said.
In answer, the same hatch opened again and out slid a tray on which reposed a small heap of strong cloth and a large rounded object made of white felt.
"What are these?" he said, fingering the rough material.
"Your garments," said the integrator.
The white rounded object turned out to be a wide-brimmed, low-crowned hat made of bleached thick felt, the brim curled under at its edge. When the fat man lifted it to examine the interior, he found that it had covered a broad band of stitched heavy cloth of the same color as the hat. When he lifted up the band, he saw that from it hung a square pouch of the same material, capacious and double-sewn, with a wide flap at its top. He slipped the strap over his head so that it lay on the back of his neck, and the pouch hung down in front. Because his stomach protruded farther than most people's, the arrangement did not provide the coverage the fat man considered essential. The integrator said,
"The strap is worn over the shoulder and across the torso like a baldric. The pouch hangs at the side."
It added,
"The choice of side is the wearer's, but the left is associated with a tendency to anti-authoritarianism among the young."
Imbri said,
"Tell me, when I step out of the hatch, will the people I encounter be similarly attired?"
"The colors of hat and pouch vary according to occupation."
"But otherwise?"
"This is the normal costume of a Fuldan."
Imbri put out of his mind the image of stepping naked into a startled or amused crowd of strangers. He seized upon the information he had just received.
"Fuldan," he said.
"You are about to go out into the world known as Fulda."
"It is not one of the foundational domains," the fat man said, referring to the grand old worlds on which humanity had settled during the first millennia of the great effloration out into the spray.
If Fulda had been one of those, he would have recognized the name.
"No," said the integrator.
"A secondary?"
Secondaries were the worlds that had been populated from the domains. They were now mostly comfortable places whose initial rough edges had long since been worn away by spreading civilization.
"No."
That left the hundreds of planets where humanity had failed to get a good grip. Some of them were home to indigenous species that had achieved intelligence and culture, even spaceflight. But most were places where sensible people would not want to live. Many were home to unique societies whose members lived by rules and customs the rest of humankind would find tiresome, if not a cause for outrage.
"What can you tell me about Fulda?" Imbri asked the integrator.
"Its name and the fact that you were about to step onto it."
"I may face danger. A shiply integrator does not discharge passengers, even unwilling ones, into peril without at least a warning."
"I pride myself on my shipliness," said the integrator, "but as you know, something has been done to my ethical constituents, rendering me unable to be of assistance. Indeed, I am unable even to regret being of no help." Imbri sighed. He tugged the pouch around to the right.
"Do Faldans go barefoot?" he said.
A pair of rudimentary sandals slid out onto the tray. He sat and put them on, then said,
"I am not comfortable appearing thus in public."
"I am to tell you that you will get used to it," said the ship.
"I would prefer not to."
"If you balk, I am required to make conditions inside me unpleasant." From somewhere, Imbri felt a sudden draft of icy air lick across his exposed skin. He shivered, then stood inside.
"Very well," he said. "Open the way."
The door to the cabin removed itself. The fat man stepped through into an unornamented corridor. A short walk brought him to an open hatch that led into a cargo hold. Standing on the metal deck was the utility vehicle he had last seen descending onto the Belmain seawall. Through the semi-transparent canopy over its operator's compartment, he could see the form of the little man who had crackled him. The long cargo bay was open, its tailgate lowered, and set inside was a man-sized emergency refuge capsule, its lid hinged open.
"I would prefer to ride in the operator's compartments," he said.
The hatch closed behind him. "In a short while, this hold will lack heat and atmosphere," the ship said. Imbri heard a faint hiss. He climbed into the carry-all's cargo bay using a fold-down step built into the tailgate and lay upon his back in the capsule. The container automatically closed itself. He heard some clicks, then a display appeared just above his face, telling him that he was insulated and had air to breathe, and that he should press the stud circled in green to summon rescue. The capsule was intended to provide a temporary environment in the case of a ship's becoming depressurized. Imbri had no hope that the beacon would operate, but he pushed the stud anyway. He was rewarded with the notice that that feature of the capsule was not functioning, and a request to report the matter to a repair service at the earliest opportunity. Now he heard the tailgate close itself, and the hum of the carryall's obviators cycling up. Then the craft lifted off the deck and moved forward. Through the opaque material of the capsule, Imbri saw the upper rim of an airlock's double hatch pass above him, to be replaced by a great splash of stars. He recognized none of them, which was to be expected, given his limited vantage. The view shifted, and he understood that the carryall had pointed its nose at the planet below and had begun its descent. Imbri craned his neck to try to catch a glimpse of the ship they were leaving behind in the hope of identifying it, but it was already gone from sight. The vehicle was buffeted briefly as it made the transition from vacuum to atmosphere, and Imbri was thrown from side to side within the capsule. Carryalls were not made for smooth ascents and descents, he knew, but soon the herky-jerky, as spacers called the experience, was behind them, and Imbri assumed they were dropping smoothly to the surface. He peered out of the side of the capsule and saw nothing of note. The landscape into which he was falling seemed to be featureless and pale of hue, without the green of forest or croplands, nor the reflection of sun on wide water, nor even any mountains. "Flat and featureless desert," he told himself. "Let us hope I am not about to be left to die of thirst and exposure." But when the carryall's landing rails bumped against solid ground, Imbri was in shade. He heard the operator's compartment canopy open and felt a small lurch in the vehicle's suspension that told him that the half-man had stepped out. He pressed the exit stud on the capsule's display and saw a timer appear, counting down minims. When it reached zero, the lid opened with a hiss. Imbri found himself looking up into the foliage of a Greg tree. That told him nothing. The Greg tree was a highly adaptable organism that first grew on one of the foundational domains and was now to be found on thousands of worlds. He levered himself up, noting as he did so that the gravity was appreciably lighter than on old Earth, and saw that beyond the tree was another, and enough of them around him to make a small grove. But when he turned his head, he saw only bright sunlight glinting off a small expanse of water. Beyond the pool was a whitish-gray plain, stretching lone and level as far as he could see. The air coming in was warm and moist. Even if Imbri had not known that he had been taken to another world, the complex, indefinable odor carried on the breeze would have told him. Every world smelled different, though the difference was usually noticed only for the first few moments of the newcomer's arrival. Imbri knew only that he had not smelled this one before. He climbed out of the capsule, lowered the tailgate, and stepped down to take a good look in all directions. There was little enough to see,
The land was level, mostly pebble-strewn bare earth, without even the scattering of hardy-looking plants to be found in most hardpan deserts he had seen. A range of low, rounded hills stood in the far distance in one direction. North, he thought, though he would need to see the sun move before he could be sure. At near hand was a small oasis, surrounding Imbri and the carryall. The vehicle had not deactivated its obviators, which hummed again as the tailgate and canopy closed themselves and the aircraft ascended smoothly into the sky. Imbri saw through the trees a tan-colored wall and a flat roof. He went toward it, walking through waist-high, feathery, fronded growths that displayed clusters of purple berries here and there. He recognized the berries without remembering their name. Like grig trees, they were a common sight around the spray. He thought there might even be some symbiotic relationship between the two species of plant. He had passed through the trees now and looked about him again, seeing nothing that offered immediate danger. Out of the shade, the sunlight was not as hot as he had expected. He noted that the color of the sky tended toward the green more than a pure blue, usually signifying a thick, moist atmosphere. That seemed odd for a place that presented itself as uncompromising desert, but he assumed he would come across an explanation somewhere down the line, if he didn't get off the planet soon, which was his preference. The ground beyond the oasis was hardpan. Desiccated soil, grittier than sand, crunched softly beneath Imbri's corrugated soles. The planet's star appeared to be similar to old Earth's, though its energy struck more lightly on the fat man's exposed skin. At least he need not worry about sunburn and its attendant ills. He went back to look at the pool and saw that it was wide enough to swim in and deep enough that he could not see the bottom, although the water was clear. He saw nothing moving in the depths. He walked around the water until he was on the same side as the one-story building he had seen earlier. It showed windows without glass and a single open doorway. The interior was shadowed until he stood in the portal, then his eyes adjusted to show him a small room, minimally furnished with a narrow cot, a chair, and a table. On the latter stood an earthenware pitcher, bowl, and tumbler. Beyond was an inner door that led to another chamber. When he crossed the floor, he found that the second room contained the same simple furnishings, with one difference. On the cot reposed the half-sized man who had stunned and kidnapped him. They regarded each other in silence for a long moment, Imbri noting that the stubbed fingers of one of the small man's hands rested on the same crackler that had brought him down beside the seawall. The other man saw the direction of Imbri's gaze and let his fingers beat a brief tattoo on the weapon while he cocked his head and delivered the fat man a meaningful look.
"Tukal, is it?" Imbri said.
The little man gave a confirmatory grunt.
"What now?"
"We wait."
"How long?"
"Not very."
"For what?"
"You'll see."
"We're not going to have long, deep, and complex conversations, are we?" Imbri said.
When it was clear that Tukal would have no response to the question, Imbri advanced another.
"What is this place?"
His finger circled to indicate the building they were in.
"A mining consortium built them long ago," the half-man said, "or so I'm told."
He turned his head away to indicate that nothing more was forthcoming. Imbri went back the way he had come. In the first room, he spoke to attract the attention of the building's integrator. There was no reply. He went back to where Tukal lay.
"No integrator?"
"You'll find," said the little man, "that Fulda is lacking in many of the amenities."
Imbri went back outside. It did not take him long to re-explore the oasis. He saw no reason to go into the desert any farther than his vision could reach. If he climbed the distant hills, he doubted that he would see much to encourage him. He did make one discovery, however. On one side of the oasis, where the grass had been cropped and torn up and the soil had been made damp then dried, he found the tracks of some splay-footed animal, indeed several different specimens judging by the individual shapes of their three broad toes. When he went to the edge of the vegetation, he found scratches in the hardpan that were almost deep enough to be called ruts. They ran toward the south. When he walked around the outer edge of the green space, he found similar markings on the hard ground on the opposite side. The trail continued toward the low hills. The sun had moved enough in the sky since he had landed that he could now deduce that it was mid-morning and that the hills lay to the north.
The information was not immediately useful, Imbri knew, but, he told himself, it's a start.
He went back to the single building, poured himself some water from the pitcher, and drank it. Then he lay back on the cot, which protested his weight before adjusting itself as best it could to his dimensions. Imbri ignored the complaint and gave himself over to thought.
Over the course of his career as a chief forger and purveyor of valuables illicitly acquired by others, he had of necessity made some persons deeply unhappy. Most of them would never know, at least not for sure, that Luff Imbrie of Orkney was the author of their discontent. He usually employed cutouts and stand-ins to keep a barrier of safety between himself and his clientele. But the high value of the goods in which Imbrie dealt meant that they were almost always the possessions of the wealthy and well-placed. These were exactly the kinds of persons who would have the means to penetrate the fat man's layers of insulating subterfuge. Careful as he might be, and he was more careful than most, he could not discount the possibility that some aggrieved magnate might some day discover that his prized Humbergruff assemblage or Bazieri portrait had been borne away by the thief Luff Imbrie. Or worse, that neither Humbergruff nor Bazieri had had the remotest connection to the work for which the magnate had paid Imbrie a handsome fee, the artwork being entirely the product of the fat man's skills as a forger. The latter scenario was worse because, while a man who had been robbed of a genuine treasure might hope to recover it, a purchaser of gilded dross could only hope to regain the funds he had been swindled out of. And though money meant a great deal to the wealthy, otherwise they would not be such, pride often meant a good deal more. Imbrie began to make two mental lists. One of persons from whom, in recent years, he had stolen artworks of significant merits, and another of those to whom he had passed gimcracks bedecked in falsified provenances. Neither list was short. He was in the prime of his career and had had much success over the past couple of dozen operations. He wondered if his accomplishments had led him to sloppiness in his arrangements. Had he chosen poorly in his circle of associates, leaving him vulnerable to whispers and behind-the-hand gossip that had led some hunter first to the unfortunate Barlow Crim and thus to Luff Imbrie? But the more he thought it through, the less likely it was that he had made the significant error that had caused him to be netted. If some magnate had discovered that he had been slipped a forgery or that his beloved collection had been rifled, it was only a matter of spending sufficient funds to send operatives out to find and squeeze the likes of Barlow Crim. Insufficient squeezings would eventually lead to Imbrie. Imbrie went through his two lists again and sketched possible responses to grievances that the names on them might lodge against him. But until he knew who had him and why, he could plan only the vaguest contingencies. He abandoned the effort and decided to husband his energies for the events Tuchel had told him to await. He formulated a rough plan in several stages. First came survival. After that, he needed information to help him to the third stage, escape from Fulda. Stage 4 would see him return to Old Earth. Stage 5 would be centered on finding out who had done this to him. Stage 6 would be his revenge. It might well be the longest and most imaginative part of the plan. He closed his eyes and allowed the cot to soothe him into slumber. When he awoke, the sun was slanting into the room at a different angle, and the air outside resounded with brayings, shouts, and the rumble of metal-shod wheels.